Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, our Christmas/holiday week in IndyCar episode presented by Cooper Tires. Really, truly enjoyed the almost hour that we had with new IndyCar president Jay Fry. Gave him a little bit of guff when we started out saying, "Hey man, are you going to charge me extra here?" When we booked this a few weeks ago, you were just a lowly IndyCar competition president, but now that you are the president, maybe this is going to cost me a little bit extra. Jay, as always, good humor, very open, willing to answer all kinds of questions, and thanks to you and everyone that sent in those questions via Facebook, via Reddit and Twitter. He was a question answering machine. Just looking at my little notes that I jotted down of all the little timestamps of what he got into, he spoke about, could IndyCar go to a double chassis option, three chassis, who knows, when it comes time for the next generation car, the car that will replace the Dallara DW12 sometime around 2022. He gets into the aero screen, its latest tests, if and when we might see it. Let's see, what else? Gets into the Robert Wickens crash and the report there. Talks a bit about the LED panels. Speaks about energy recovery systems, electrification of IndyCar, if and when that might happen, whether the Laguna Seca circuit will have any adjustments made to it prior to the first test coming up here in February, NASCAR crossovers in some way, shape, or form, what else? Just all kinds of stuff. Lots of good fun stuff. A lot of track stuff, too. Could we go back here? Could we go there? Is this on your radar? So great stuff with Jay. Thanks again for him. Take some time out here, frankly, when everyone's just trying to shut down for a few days. And we're going to get this up here, obviously, just before Christmas, so you have it for the week, because I'm trying to take a little bit of time off myself. With all that said, thanks to those who sent in a lot of great questions here from me, and I'll get to those in just a moment. Last thing I'll mention is, while this is the last, call it normal, week in IndyCar episode of the year where you send in questions and I answer them, my guests answer them, we are going to try and put together, call it a final episode of the year a little bit later in the week, just more of a reflection piece with Robin Miller as a guest, my pal, my longtime colleague and fellow IndyCar reporter at Racer.com, and provided he's available, our man Lee Diffie, another favorite guest of the podcast, lead announcer on NBCSN's IndyCar coverage. They will have that for all of 2019 and beyond, which is great. So going to try and get on the phone here with Robin and Lee. Just say, hey guys, tell me about your favorite memories of the year and any other thoughts that come together. Just do that as a little bit of a reflection to close 2018. As we do on every episode this year of the Week in IndyCar, our good friends at TorontoMotorsports.com award t-shirts to those who've sent in the question that I liked most from the previous week. We broke tradition recently, where instead of picking one, I picked two. And hey, since this is the last listener-driven week in IndyCar for the year, we're going to go ahead and break tradition again. And so Jamie Carr and also Zachary Burcham, send me a direct message with your address. Addresses, unless you live together, therefore it'd be address. Addresses and your t-shirt sizes, and our good friends at TorontoMotorsports.com will ship off Week in IndyCar t-shirts to you. And they're awesome. The Roger Warwick cartoon there I'm quite fond of. And just the t-shirts themselves, instead of them being the inexpensive ones to maximize profits, we decided, hey, let's do the more expensive ones that are really, really nice. So drop me a line, guys. Give me your mailing info and your shirt sizes. We'll get you hooked up there. Definitely want to mention that our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com, even though we are butted up right against Christmas here, still have tons of great stuff on sale and for sale there. All kinds of racing memorabilia, t-shirts, models, stickers, hats. Being in Toronto, not a surprise, there's a ton of great James Hinchcliffe content, Robert Wickens content, and so on. Definitely recommend you check out TorontoMotorsports.com. And if you happen to be in the United States, little secret here, our dollar does pretty good in Canada. You're going to stretch it further than you would most places, and shipping, I believe, although they present the maximum cost possibilities, tends to be fairly low. So some good money to save there, and a lot of savings to be had on all kinds of cool content to fill up your office or give to friends or just be the person that wears 29 pieces of IndyCar flair. All right, let's get to the questions you sent in for me. And once I'm done there, we're going to roll right into our man, Jay Fry. Let's go with Rob Perry first, who asks, how much does an IndyCar cost to run for the year? Great question, Rob. Also, as an Australian, I think, mechanic friend said many years ago to me when I asked a question like this, he said, how long is a piece of string? Of which there is no answer. It could be somewhere in the 5-ish million. You might be able to squeak for something just a tiny bit less than that, Rob, but there is no such thing as a set cost in IndyCar. If you look at all the minimums of piling on an engine lease at about $1.12 million for the year, a tire lease that is going to get, you know, higher in the six-figure range, salaries and vehicles and just all kinds of stuff, you'd be hard-pressed to do it for less than probably $4.5 million, I would say. Five is really about where the minimum target has crept to. I'd say the sweet spot in general has been between 6 and 8. 6 being we're going to be competitive, we might get a win, but I don't know if we're going to bank on a whole lot more. And if you start getting up into that 8 range, that starts to have teams feeling more comfortable. They're able to dump plenty of that money back into R&D stuff, all of the shaker rigs, computational fluid dynamics for wind tunnel testing and such, virtual wind tunnel testing, real wind tunnel, all the kinds of things that you want to do off track to improve your vehicle so that when you show up for St. Petersburg here in a couple of months, you kick all kinds of butt. So 6 to 8 is kind of the sweet spot folks aim for, Rob. Not everybody hits that. Some folks, I'm guessing, I know actually one team that goes above. Been rumored about a 10 to 11 million for one car. So, you know, that's the general spot. It's more than I make, I can tell you that. I would be able, if I was an IndyCar entrant, I would probably be able to afford to run 2 front wheels and maybe a rear wing. That's about all I think I could afford on an annual basis. But that's me. I'm striving to do better. Keith Lee says, Marshall, question about the Harding Steinbrenner / Andretti Racing team receiving pressure to switch to Honda. A little bit of an old-timey question. How did the Tasman Forsyth Racing team get away with running Tony Kanaan back in the day with a Honda, while the Forsyth Champion Racing team was running a Mercedes, and mentioned that he knows that owners applied pressure to fix that? Well, here's the reality, Keith. We've got 2 manufacturers today. Back in the day, when we're talking this kart era, we would have had, again, depending on the general eras, 3, 4, sometimes 5, all kinds of options. So the alignment, while one would always love to be aligned with the same manufacturer with everything you do, today there's 2 choices. And, you know, as we've had a lot of desire on Honda's part to remove any conflict, potential conflict of interest with the Harding Steinbrenner team continuing with Chevys that Harding used in 2017 and 2018, I'd say the sensitivities are a bit higher. It's 2 camps, strictly 2 camps. And so that's where you get a lot of aggro. Anytime you've got 3, 4, 5 manufacturers in the room, it's obviously less of a head-to-head pressure. So I think just different time, and certainly less of a head-to-head dynamic like we have now. Mark Brown, love this. Marshall, please ask if the race at Road America has a chance to go longer, maybe 4 or 5 hours. You know, I thought about this one for a minute, Mark, and I was like, well, and then I realized, that's a great idea. I was trying to think of the ways where it couldn't work, and it could. I mean, granted, I think most teams would want to go in with relatively fresh brakes installed on the car and all kinds of other things. And, you know, maybe it'd be more mileage on the engine in one event than either Honda or Chevy would be happy about. But I love this idea. You know, our driver is going to be thoroughly worn out after 4 hours. I'd say so. You know, they tend to be about an hour 40, hour 50 now. Doubling that up, I like that idea. I really, truly do. Maybe if we could have our dear friends at Road America outfit the track with some overhead lighting, some of the mobile Musco lighting or whatnot, maybe we start this late afternoon, kind of a transition into sunset and into evening. I think that would be a freaking rock and roll thing. So, Mark, great, great question slash idea. And now I have yet another thing to bother IndyCar's leadership about. Say, hey, need to do it. Need to do it. Our pal Dan Glass at Texan Hombre. You've sent this in a couple times, Dan. I love it. I love the aspirational angle. Thanks for putting up old races on YouTube, IndyCar. Is there a reason, reasoning for which ones get picked? Are y'all trying to gauge interest for what might be added to the calendar? I would love if it was that kind of sneaky sub under the radar, Dan. I would also, you know, say that if you think that folks sitting in any kind of leadership management or upper communications level at IndyCar are in the offices there at 16th and Georgetown saying, okay, we're going to put up Milwaukee 1988 and let's see how that does. And if we get enough views and that's an indicator to go back. I wish that was the case. It certainly isn't. I would not link any of the things that show up on IndyCar's YouTube page, especially the old-timey stuff, being associated with folks who are truly just plugged in trying to get market data on where they should go. And we actually get into this a little bit with Jay. It wasn't piggybacking off your question, but how do you get to certain circuits? Why do you talk to certain circuits? And so, yeah, would love it if it was the case. Just isn't. Our pal Nick Dovbiniak has sent in. He said, will we ever see mixed class open wheel racing? Not for ovals, but some of the road courses would lend to this. Maybe at the road to Indy level so as not to dilute the, quote, show. I don't think ever, Nick. Not as if there aren't some pretty amazing Indy Lights drivers, but yeah, closing speeds, top speeds, all kinds of speeds, experience, talent in some cases. There aren't always great Indy Lights drivers. There's usually a donkey or two. Trust me, if I was driving, I would be well below a donkey. But yeah, I don't foresee this ever happening, ever. Too much of sticking the spoon in the light socket here. I think this would, as crazy as it would be to watch, and I would be watching, at least kind of covering my eyes and just looking through the little gaps in my fingers. I think this would be one where there'd be a lot of cautions and a lot of parts sales at the Dallara trailer. Let's go to Jeff Hildebrand 29. Hello, Jeff. Now this, thanks for sending this in, Jeff. This is funny. Marshall, I'm currently enjoying the book, How to Build a Car by Adrian Newey. Adrian Newey being one of the world's greatest, all-time greatest race car designers, also race engineer back in the day. Besides the obvious differences, are there any similarities between yourself and Newey in regard to the early love of racing, building cars, etc.? Wishing you and your bride a Merry Christmas. Thanks, Jeff. The passion part, of course. I've said this before on our lovely week in IndyCar podcast presented by Cooper Tires. When I worked in IndyCar, and before that in what we call today the Road Indy, all the junior formulas up through Indy Lights for many years, and then in IndyCar, I worked both in CART and the Indy Racing League. Again, as the progression came up, went from being a mechanic to more and other things into engineering and management, I was good at what I did. And I always make that distinction. I was good. Was not great. Was never great. I might have had glimpses of great for 30 seconds here and 45 seconds there, but I was an average person working for teams. That's not false humility. That's just being honest. I work around and have always worked around great people. I just would not rate myself as one. So therefore, when we talk about Adrian Newey, I mean, that's at least on the crew side, technical side, the world that I came from before moving to the media. I mean, that's like some Hall of Fame pantheon greatness. So I truly, other than being a human being and male, I can't find too many strands of connectivity to say that there's anything that I've ever done that would fall anywhere in the category of an Adrian Nui. I would love to just spend time talking with him because he is a personal hero. He has been since, I think, about 1988 when his March Formula One car, naturally aspirated thing with a Judd V8 going up against the great McLaren MP44 Honda designed by Gordon Murray, driven by one of my heroes, Ayrton Senna. I mean, this is a guy whose car, on a comparative penny of a budget and no power whatsoever, was just, I mean, it was clearly the gem of the season. So anyways, I've been an Adrian Newey fan forever. It tickles me, and I appreciate the question, but no. I mean, I loved being a mechanic. I loved working on the cars, building them either brand new, and when we would get something new showing up from Swift or Crosley or whatever it was, loved building them from scratch, repairing them, maintaining them, running them, being a mechanic, all the way up through, again, IndyCar, spent some time in IMSA as well on the GTP side, loved it, had a great desire to be a race car designer, probably fueled in part by Adrian Newey, and so took a lot of CAD classes and did some designs of this, that, and the other, and, you know, definitely just confirmed the point that the world needs Adrian Newey far more than me in that space. So glad you're enjoying the book, though. It's one that I recommend everybody picks up if you happen to be a person that loves the technical side of the sport and learn a lot about design. Also going to get, you know, some cool little history lessons as well. So Adrian Newey's book, How to Build a Car, quadruple thumbs up on that. And thanks for the question, Jeff. Getting to the last of the questions for me here. The next three are all from the Reddit IndyCar group. Thanks, Michael Swope, for firing these over to me. First one comes in from Jenico1, who says, with the announcement today of Dragon Speed entering IndyCar on a part-time basis and looking to be a full-time participant in 2020, what can we expect from them as a team and Ben Hanley as a driver? There's another question after that. All depends. And so that's a really generic answer. But let me flesh it out just a little bit. It really depends. Speaking with Elton, having known about this for, you know, a while, I think Elton reached out to me first when he was wanting to do this and gave him a variety of contacts for folks to reach out to about getting a lease for this or whatever for that. It was clear from the outset and remains clear that they want to do this on their own. Looked like there was a point where they might have been forced into partnering with another team because Dragon Speed, at least an open wheel, completely unknown entity. So I think there was a lack of comfort there. That comfort's been found, I believe. And so we're going to have them as a standalone effort. I don't believe they're planning to hire anyone else for this. I mean, if they do, not a big deal, but the mindset here is they want to do this on their own, prove they can do it on their own, prove they have the engineering, managerial, mechanical talent, and driving talent. And so we are going to find out what that is. We do not know what it is, though. That's the huge question that can't be answered at this point. How will they look when they show up at COTA for turning the very first laps with the brand new car they've bought with Hanley? Don't know. Cannot say. What are they going to look like at St. Pete? Don't know. We can say for sure of the things that we know that matter a lot in IndyCar when it comes to being successful, no matter who you are, and that is a super high quality engineer and a complementary damper program, one where those shocks are pretty badass and tuned to the needs of every single track. Well, they're going to the five tracks they've listed for the first time, all of them, I believe. So could that be an area that leaves them behind? Yeah. Is that something where it would make it hard to really figure out the quality of the overall team versus starting from scratch on an IndyCar damper development program and just needing to get through a year, maybe two, to really hit the sweet spot, that could certainly be mitigating circumstances. So, not sure what we're going to see, but there is a steep learning curve in place. I know they are good, very good at what they do in LMP1 racing and LMP2. They are very confident Hanley is going to just fit right in IndyCar. I have a feeling he will do the same, but I don't know what we're looking at. Is it another Jordan King? Is it a Pietro Fittipaldi? Is it a Charlie Kimball? Is it a Max Chilton? I'm not sure. Will Ben have the speed to belong? I think there's no question. Absolutely. Are they going to be bothering the Firestone Fast 12 first time out? Can't wait to get to St. Pete and find out. Jenico1 also says, also with the Indy 500 car count continuing to grow, are there any teams, like Juncos, at risk of falling out of IndyCar altogether should they fail to qualify due to a lack of funding, sponsorships, or so on and so forth? It says, I seem to recall Junco saying something along the lines of this last year, that had they failed to qualify for the 20, I guess this past May's, Indy 500. Yeah, there aren't a ton of Indy-only programs coming in that if they fail to qualify this year, again, I apologize, for 2019, their entire business and program would fall apart. And there's some, if we think of Dreyer and Reinbold, it'd be a huge hit. I mean, I'm not saying it wouldn't be a huge hit, but if Dennis's team, for whatever reason, say, didn't make the show, I don't think that's going to happen. I'm just citing them as a one-off. If they don't make the show, it's going to suck. But do I think Dennis's team shuts down as a result? No. Juncos, I still don't know what Ricardo is going to have for the season. And, you know, he and I have a really good relationship. He's always straightforward with me. And when we spoke recently, he said, look, and I wrote about this on Racer, got a lot of people saying, hey, IMSA, DPI, Cadillac, woo, let's go. They just signed, thankfully, the young and awesome Dutchman, Rinus VK, the reigning Pro Mazda champion. So he will be the leader of the Juncos Indy Lights program. IndyCar? Not totally sure where that's going to lead. Kyle Kaiser, who drove for them in a couple of rounds last year, the 2017 Indy Lights champ. Well, keep in mind he brought that $1 million prize from Mazda and IndyCar to at least, you know, expedite some races with the team. And he's been out searching for money. Keep in mind he's starting at zero without that Mazda money. You only get it once. But he's out looking for funding to hopefully do more IndyCar races. He's found enough to do the Rolex 24 with the team, but that's just not a huge, huge number by comparison. So I've got him looking around. Rene Binder, I know who Ricardo has said is, you know, still interested maybe in doing things. Also saw that Rene has signed for a European sports car team in P2 and is going to be doing a lot of that, along with the Rolex 24 with Juncos Racing. Just getting back to the point here, Monsieur or Mrs. Jenico 1, we don't know what Juncos Racing is going to look like when we do get to St. Pete, much less the Indy 500. One of the few things that's actually worrying me at this stage of the year, I realize that we have more or less all of the seats filled in. Carlin Racing is the other one that, you know, we know Max Chilton is going to be back, but we're not sure about exactly how the second car and possibly a third car, the makeup of that. But yeah, at least coming in from Ricardo, he's saying, you know, boy, I wish I could tell you the phone was ringing from interested drivers locally in the States or in Europe or even South America, wherever. Hasn't really been the case. So if that were to happen, if Ricardo were to only find money for the 500, back to your question and closing that out, and they didn't make the show, yeah, I think we might be looking at some really hard questions they need to ask. I mean, here's the biggest thing. They debuted at the 2017 Indy 500 with two cars. They came back this year with one car, not full-time, but full-time-ish, almost. Three drivers, did the majority of the schedule. If we're going into what is year three for them, if we're hearing that the phones are almost silent, I don't think that's a conviction of the team so much. It's still a young team, and we know that. It's not a Penske, but you also can't get into Penske. You can't get into Ganassi. Andretti has no openings, and so on and so forth. So this, to me, speaks more of not as many funded and interested drivers on the market right now as maybe we would hope. All right, last couple here. We're going to go to another Reddit question from Silly Pseudonym. And in addition to that question, at what point does the uptick in car count begin to push the limits on Honda and Chevy? We hear about it, but haven't seen anyone hit the brick wall and come to a stop since Shank 1.0 a few years back. That referring to Chevy and Honda not making engines available for Mike Shank after he bought a car, trying to enter the 2012 season, only Lotus saying they would, and Shank saying no, and then selling the car to Eric Bachelard. And also says, we're seeing articles posted on here talking about 36 to 40 cars entering the race next May or in 2020. What's realistically the absolute ceiling for these two manufacturers? I can tell you that of the two, one of them has told me 19 is it. That's it. So provided that's the case, and provided that doesn't slide to 20, if 19's the number, and in theory the other manufacturer could or would, I shouldn't say could, it's a willingness thing, and it's a willingness to lose more money than they're comfortable with. But if the other manufacturer is willing to get into that similar range, which I haven't seen that, usually more the 17 range, maybe 18, but you know, if you take that 18 or 19, if you take 18, you apply the 19 on the other side, you're 37. So the 36 to 40 isn't too crazy, but I'd say 40 would be, that would take some holy cow, what changed policy-wise internally, because that would obviously be either some form of 20-20 split or one creeping over 20. So with only two manufacturers, I just cannot imagine that day based on what they've told me. So, yeah, I would say 36 would be amazing in a field of 33. Could that stretch to 38? Today, you know, here the last week of 2018, that's about all I can imagine. It would take some modified willingness on the manufacturer's part to even get to 40. So, but in terms of that uptick, you know, the interesting part is it's not just engines and availability. What they talk about all the time is we're pulling engine support techs from everywhere imaginable. Our sports car programs, our off-road programs, we just don't have enough bodies in the building under our current employment to satisfy this. And I haven't heard much of, hey, we're going to hire five extra people just for the month of May from either manufacturer, just from a spending standpoint. So that's usually where it comes back to. We've reached our critical mass on how many people we can dispatch to look after y'all. Okay, last two. Ruslar, again from Reddit. Will the NBC Gold Package include an ad-free race stream? Surely the entire U.S. motorsports broadcasting industry had to take note of the overwhelming positive reaction to ESPN's ad-free F1 broadcasts. Still chasing this. I don't think the answer is yes, yet. I did speak with a friend at IndyCar's awesome broadcaster and was referred to someone else. And again, apologies for referencing the week that we are in, but not a lot of folks are sitting around right now to either answer emails or pick up the phone, so might not get an answer to this until early into the new year, but definitely want to get an answer for you, because I know it's something that a lot of folks are curious about. We'll go to the last question here, coming in from Twitter, and this comes from Garrick Obe, or Obe, and I apologize if I just murdered your last name. Will the upcoming horsepower increase in IndyCar help or hurt the racing? This referencing Jay Fry's goal in 2021 to start out on this five-ish year creep towards 1,000 horsepower, hoping to be in the 800 plus to start, 850 or so, and creep up from there. As for help or hurt, I mean, I would just say that IndyCar would be going back to a place that it has been many times. I mean, dating back to the early 70s, when more than 1,000 horsepower was being pumped out by Offenhauser four-cylinder turbos with turbochargers the size of a freaking basketball. IndyCar has been a 1,000-ish, 800-plus horsepower formula for most of my lifetime. Decades and decades. That's only changed since this 2012 formula came down the pipeline. And we've gotten to a place recent years, where when we go to road courses in high boost, these 2.2-liter turbos are putting out over 700 horsepower. But they weren't necessarily doing that the first couple of years. And when we go to some of the big ovals and such, and they turn down the boost, you know, you're talking, 550, maybe 600, I don't know, not a lot. So as for help or hurt, I don't think there's really going to be any negatives to this at all. This is just going back to a place where we've been, and we can think about whether it's kart, champ car, whatever. There's been great racing for decades and decades in those series. In this case, knowing that the one key difference is, unlike most of those times, we do have a spec chassis, it means that all of the cars will be doing the same relative speed just as they do today, only a bit faster. So I think the real goal here, the real thing that's going to come out of this, is not really a changing the quality of racing in a positive or negative way, Garrick. It's going to just be more entertaining for us as fans, journalists, and whomever else. If you get a chance to not be in one of them and just watch them going by, it should be more of a holy crap type experience. I mean, there's other aspects that are going to come into this as well. Thinking about the current formula again, in that top power 700-ish, 750-ish, brake systems are sized to fit that, to slow the cars at the relative top speeds that they hit. If we look at the downforce the cars are making in various configurations and the drag coming off of them, they're hitting, you know, top speeds that are impressive, but we know they will definitely be higher unless they bolt on a ton more downforce or drag with this new 2021 chassis. Don't foresee that happening at all. What this is going to mean is it's going to be some resizing of things. Would expect bigger brakes, more awesome brakes, more cooling to those brakes. Everything around the car should be uprated to deal with getting to, say, brake zones at the end of a long straight faster. Not only is the elapsed time going to decrease, but the speed when they arrive at those brake zones will be higher. So, again, would expect the rest of the cars to be modified to suit. But I just think it's going to be pretty awesome. Having been someone, you know, again, on the crew side and also just, heck, even the fan side, the days of Indy cars that were scary, I mean, just as a fan, think about Long Beach and the times that I, you know, in the, whether it was the late 80s or early 90s at some point, there were, you know, a couple of times where working for an Atlantic team or whatever else, and you know, was done with whatever I was doing and would walk over to the fence for 10 or 15 minutes to watch the IndyCar session. And it's just, holy crap! The thing going by is making so much sound and fury, punching such a nasty hole through the air. You just feel everything. Just the screaming, raging monster caged within this fencing at Long Beach, or again, pick many other tracks they go to. The bigger road courses where they really stretch their legs, or the super speedways too. It's just a different thing, Garrick. It really is. The cars going much faster and exploding off of the corners harder and whistling through the corners at speeds that just don't even seem possible. We have some of that now. We don't necessarily have the explosion off the corners bit or the holy cow top speeds. We've got the holy cow cornering. We've had that for many years now. But just going back to a formula of truly awesome, call it everything about the cars. All aspects of the cars were maximum everything. And the viewing of those vehicles was, yeah, just a religious experience. So for what I'm expecting, I don't think the racing is going to change in any noticeable way. What I do expect is for those who go to the races, they are going to walk away going, holy cow, what was that that I just saw? And hopefully there will be even more reverie for the drivers who are putting on the show. And, you know, last thing I'll mention here quickly is there's one driver, an IndyCar champion, who has told me more than once how bummed out he is that the vast majority of his career will have been spent in this DW12 lower power era. And it's for drivers like him, who are all-time greats, where I say, huh, I can't wait for you. I hope you're going to hang around long enough to strap into whatever this, I assume it's going to be a Dallara. I doubt there's going to be multiple chassis, but Jay will tell you more about that. But what I assume is going to be a Dallara, they probably won't call it a DW22 for the year 2022, since Dan Weldon will not have been involved in it. But whatever they call it, the IR22, that chassis with the 2021 engine formula going to that 2.4 liter V6 twin turbo, I think that's going to be something where you're going to have a lot of drivers who've been in IndyCar for a while, who've kind of only known the DW12, to just be smiling like mad going, cool, this is how I want to spend the last 5, 10, however many years of my career, because this thing is just a ball of fury and bad assness. All right, well, let's get to our man, Jay Fry. Our holiday, our Christmas week in IndyCar episode, all kinds of questions and answers, especially answers coming from our man. And thank you for listening. Thank you, truly, for all of the really kind and wonderful things you have shared, especially in recent months, knowing that my dear wife has been going through some pretty significant medical issues. So just a lot of y'all have been, you know, awesome. That part's a given. Thank you. Not pandering. I'm just saying, you know, the feedback that I get from y'all by and large is pretty amazing. But just the encouragements, the wonderful little emails, notes, texts, whatever. Thanks. I mean, truly thanks. This could have been a crappy, depressing boys this year ending on a low type thing, and instead it's been the opposite. My lady is recovering incredibly well, and so much of this has just been nice to wake up. And she looks at my Twitter feed, by the way, something I've learned very recently. So when y'all send along little notes and whatnot, she's getting to them as well, and she's seeing them. So thanks for listening. Thanks for all the encouragement and support that you offer. Thanks for helping my silly little podcast to really kind of take off this year. And thanks to Cooper Tires, who not only became my first sponsor for 2018 and primary sponsor for 2018, a little hashtag breaking exclusive scoop, they're back for 2019, and I'm a really happy boy. And we've got a couple of other partners that I'm looking forward to hopefully announcing here soon. So this little podcast thing's taken off, and thank you for making it a thing. All right. Once again, thanks to our pals at Cooper Tires. Thanks to you for sending in the great questions. And off we go with the man, the new IndyCar Prez O'Dent. Jay Fry, you know, when we booked this a couple weeks ago, you were just like a lowly IndyCar competition president. Then you went and got the big old upgrade to IndyCar president. So I don't know, man. Am I going to have to crowdfund some extra, you know, extra money to pay for heavy hitter now at IndyCar on the podcast?
Crazy. Well, it's funny how it almost looks like this was planned, right? That when we did, you know, like you said, we set this up a couple weeks ago, and then boom, here we this happened this week, and boom, here we are. So certainly glad to be here. Very excited about you know, all the things that we've announced this week and what's going on. Also, I mean, extremely flattered, overwhelmed almost about all the texts, social media stuff, well wishes that we've received. It's been, I mean, it's really been overwhelming, and I really appreciate what everybody's saying.
Well, that's awesome, and hopefully we won't set that back too far with some of the questions that we got in this week. We got a lot of great questions. As we often do, I try and sort them into categories if there's some themes that emerge. honestly, there are so many really good ones that are both lighthearted or serious or otherwise forward-looking. I figured it might just be best to have a little bit of a jumble here. So why don't we kick off with our pal Tom Schreier, who says, I think Jay's promotion is a great thing. Seems like the right person to lead the series. Jay, do you have any concerns about having the bandwidth to keep your finger on the pulse of the competition side while leading these other new areas at the same time? And I have to admit, I had the same thought knowing how busy you are already.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think a lot of what's been going on, I've already been kind of doing it, you know, or to a degree, a small group. We all pitch in to do many different things on a daily basis. So I think that'll be okay. Also, think about it. We're a racing league. We're a racing series. We race cars. So all the other things that we've talked about that we've just assumed or taken on are part of that. And at the end of the day, it's all about the competition. It's all about, what happens on the racetrack. So I think it should be pretty seamless. We've got some great people in those roles, that we've just kind of merged everybody together now. So excited about it. And, I think we'll be okay.
All right. Let's go to Neil Joseph, who asks, is there any concern within the series about a lack of ovals on the calendar? And if so, what is the series trying to do to protect them? And I guess I'd also add maybe expand. And this is in reference to Phoenix coming off the calendar for 2019. So we're down one overall oval. But what are your thoughts looking ahead 2020 plus? Do you think we can not only save the ones we have, but make sure we maybe add one or two?
Yeah, no, and that's a great question. Obviously, from my background in history, very much an oval person, love oval racing. I think this year it wasn't any, intention. We just had the opportunity to go to a great facility at Circuit of the Americas that would fit into that time slot or around that time slot that Phoenix was. So it was certainly not any way a reflection on our thoughts on ovals. We're very committed to ovals. We just happen to be one short now because of that, because of the COTA situation. But we're certainly conscious of the mix. There's some great ovals that we're currently not going to that could be, in the mix going forward. So, again, I guess, the short answer of the question is very committed to ovals, very committed to the mix of our diversity that we have of our schedule. So I guess just kind of stay tuned for what could be next.
I'll maybe throw in here quickly because this question comes up somewhat often. Why don't you go back to and pick the Milwaukee, Kentucky, Loudon, pick wherever it might be if we're talking ovals. And while I know that there would be a great interest to go to 100 ovals, there's not just the, hey, IndyCar would like to go there factor. Maybe, Jay, share a little bit of the practical realities of, is there a promoter at that track that wants IndyCar? Is there a belief that they could make money at this? Is there an audience in that region that might respond to IndyCar? It's not just a case of you and Mark Miles throwing darts at the map saying, okay, we're going to go there because it sounds like fun.
Yeah. Well, true. If you look at the holistic picture of the whole motorsports world, right? There's certain, NASCAR goes to certain places at certain times of the year. Obviously, they go to those places because of weather, different things that are part of different years. So that's part of the big picture of things. There's the broadcast, our great broadcast partner at NBC, that also comes into the equation too. So there's a handful of ovals that I would say that would be something that could be very appealing to us going forward. Again, it depends on how the overall schedule and calendar play out, and where we're at, where others are at, where NBC's at. So it's funny, when I first got into this role a couple years ago, I didn't realize the schedule was that difficult. Being a former competitor, you look and you go, hey, why don't they just do that? That's kind of, it's very obvious that's the right way to go. And why don't they do that? Well, now I understand from a much bigger picture perspective of how difficult sometimes what's most obvious is to do. So there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle. Again, our biggest thing is we want to make sure we keep the mix. We think we've got a very diverse calendar, the diversest schedule in the motorsports world. So we want to make sure to maintain that.
All right. Let's go to Thomas Gross, who says, what are a few of the potential solutions for not having enough pit boxes at a few of the tracks next season, and do you think, quote, bumping might take place at some of those tracks? And that's in reference to what could be pretty healthy car counts at some circuits. So I know you've been very forthright in saying, hey, we're not wanting to send anybody home at pick the track, Long Beach or Mid-Ohio or wherever else. But if you do get into a situation, Jay, where the car counts are looking pretty stout, how do you manage that in terms of giving everybody a home on pit lane?
Yeah, well, that's something we were conscious of. I think you and I talked about last fall. Obviously, like you mentioned, it's really a good problem to have. There's a couple venues that are tight. There's some. We're looking at a couple of different ways that we can accommodate different numbers of cars. So I think we'll be okay. I think part of it, you can. There's some places where the pit boxes are pretty long. We can shorten them up a little bit to add a couple. There's a couple that have some other challenges. But again, like we mentioned, this is a really good problem to have. It's a problem that we will get sorted and we'll figure out. And I don't really see a big problem with that going forward.
All right. Kale Peister says, has there been any progress that you can speak about on a second race in Canada? And mentions that with just local real estate development encroaching on the exhibition place in Toronto, is there a contingency plan to maybe move that race, if you have to another local area in the future?
Well, I certainly hope not. We love racing in Toronto. Toronto is a great city. The location where we race is spectacular, right there in the water. So I don't anticipate that. We love racing in Canada in general. There's some other places that we've looked at and we'll continue to look at, you know, down the road. But that's not to replace Toronto. It would be in addition to Toronto. So, I don't anticipate anything changing in Toronto, hopefully for years to come. The Green Savory guys do a great job there. The fans are very enthused about having us. We're very enthused about being there. It's a really nice selling point, or one of them, you know, about the series that, you know, some of the big cities we race in, and we race right in the city, which is really cool. So look forward to a great future in Toronto.
Let's go to Zachary Campbell, and this came up when we had Mark Miles on just recently talking about esports. And I'll tell you, it really does look like this is an area where more and more IndyCar fans are hoping they're going to learn news about an esports solution. Zachary says, with the announcement of Porsche and NASCAR also investing $100,000 or more in their own iRacing.com esports series this week, is there a possibility of an esports investment from IndyCar in a similar vein in the near future?
Well, this is one thing that I'm just kind of getting early into on you know, with this kind of the new expanded role, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
I know we've met with numerous groups about this, and we have for the last probably year and a half. I got to get a better understanding of where we're at and what we're looking at. I've been part of some of it as we went through it. Obviously, it is something that's very relevant and very important, and I'm sure we're going to get into it in some way. Just at this point, it would be hard to answer exactly kind of which direction or what could be possible. I think a lot of people are very enthused. We do a lot of things right now in, you know, the video game world. People are enthused about having our cars and our participation, so to assume it would be the same way in an e-sport type situation. So we'll get on that. We're going to have something at some point, and hopefully it'd be really good.
It sounds like, though, even though you're getting up to speed in this in your new president role, it's pretty clear. It sounds like there's a clear message that is coming in that, hey, we need to be there. Can't say exactly when,
yeah.
You know, we can't tell you the date, but we know we need to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I've been involved with it some, over the last, like I mentioned, year and a half. There's a lot of really good ideas, a lot of really good possible opportunities. I just need to get a status of where we're currently at, and I'm sure we've, got a clear definition of what could be next. So I just got to get up to speed on that, and we will do that very shortly.
Next one comes in from Twitter at Leonard PDX. I assume you're in the lovely, lovely city of Portland there, Leonard. He says, with a new chassis planned in the next few years, Jay, what is the likelihood that IndyCar would select two manufacturers for added competition?
Well, our partner at Dallara is, we feel spectacular, and has done a great job for a very long time with us. And I think the proof is in the pudding with this, you know, the new aero kit we have. Kind of if you go back a little bit to this 5-year plan we've talked about, and really the 5-year plan now is expanded through 2026 with the new engine coming out. The 5-year plan basically calls for to have 3 manufacturers with 8 teams apiece, or 8 entries apiece.
Engine manufacturers, yes.
Yes, correct. So we'd have 3 engine manufacturers, you know, currently our great partners at Chevrolet and Honda, then hopefully the third, and then you know, there would be 24 full-time running cars. So once that happens, then there are other things start to organically grow, right? So each of those buckets of manufacturers, things change, new teams come in, they grow organically, but that would be the baseline to get started. Obviously, in year one of that, it would be maybe difficult to do because of contracts and current situations. But again, you know, the whole i.e., it looks good on paper plan, it looks good on paper. So having said that, if we get to that point, or a fourth manufacturer and the sport starts to even grow more, is something like that possible? Sure. But it's something that's it's very much down the road. Again, we're very comfortable with Dallara and all they've done. And, again, they're great partners. And this is, again, like we mentioned earlier about, it's very difficult to do all they do, and they make it look easy. So we couldn't be more proud of our relationship with them.
Let me ask a little bit of a mindset question to piggyback on this. I'm not asking you to confirm anything, but the iconic committee that ultimately chose Dallara as the manufacturer and produced the DW12, that committee, that submission for chassis constructors that took place throughout 2010, the way that was done, Jay, and I realize this is many years before you joined IndyCar, it was not just a request for solicitations from existing manufacturers, proven ones that we know, but also, hey, if you have a desire, send us something. So there were a lot of new entities formed, or at least proposed, hey, this group over here says they could do a chassis, although they've never really done one before like this, etc. At least if you're thinking about the future and possibly putting out more requests for proposals on chassis, do you think you might lean towards those who are out there in the marketplace now and prove that they can do high-quality open-wheel cars compared to just throwing it out to anyone and everyone?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. I mean, we can't show up without something being done, right? So we can't get in that situation. So there's, you know, a handful of groups that have proven that they can do it and have done it in the past are doing it somewhere else. So, you know, that's where you would start. You know, and when we did the Aero Kit, I mean, we did talk to others. We owe that to our, you know, to the series and to our paddock. Again, Dallara, they won the business hands down, and that was always what we thought would happen. But they're a very good partner. They've made a huge commitment. You see the commitment; it's right down the street. And you know, I don't see anything, you know, changing in that regard.
10-4. Let's jump over to our pal John Sable. So we're getting to some of the highlight questions that I know folks have been hoping to get updates on. John says, "What's happening on the aero screen front? And is implementation at the start of the season, or maybe sometime after the 2019 season gets underway, still feasible?"
Well, that's a great question, and it's something we work on every day and have been for some time. Actually, it's good timing of the question too, that we have screens today, or yesterday and today, that are being tested, the ballistic type testing and crash type testing. So we should have some more data by the end of this week, hopefully by the first next week, and that kind of, as we go through this process, that creates the next step. So we'll have more news on that, you know, hopefully shortly.
And I know you guys have been working hard to not just, let's say, test the aero screens that folks might have seen in action months ago, but this has been an ongoing development as well, Jay. Again, and I don't think we're giving anything away there, but this hasn't just been the, hey, that thing you might have seen test at Phoenix, you know, early in the year or at Indy or wherever. We're chucking stuff at that to see how it fares. You and PPG and your technical team have been constantly working on evolving not only the screen itself, but the mounting piece that it attaches to and such. This has really been an ongoing thing for you, too.
Yeah, absolutely. The original one, The original one was kind of like it would be laid up with carbon fiber almost. You look at it like that, how it was. So that's part of what, there were some spots, and we knew where these spots were, and the drivers pointed out the spots, which we thought was really cool that they could see that. The production pieces will be much more, per se, a vacuum form type piece that will be unbelievably clear. We've seen a couple of them. I mean, you can put it on the ground, and when the sun hits it just right, it almost disappears. It almost becomes, it's just very, very clear.
Wow.
So we're very comfortable with that, and then how that will look going forward, the shape. You know, we've looked at some little bit different shapes from what we've tested. Obviously, the shape of it matters, you know, and the size of it matters, and the height of it matters on how much it protects. So that's part of it. Different shapes also create different, for no better word, issues. You know, when it does, sure, sure, when something hits it, you know, how it deflects or flexes, or what's possible, or do you have to have a brace, or there's so many different things, and we want to make sure when we do it right, obviously. So there's been no stone unturned as we went through this process. We've seen other things that are obviously out there. There's good and bad to everything you do. And we just want to make sure we really do the right thing.
Let's go to Eric Franklin, who asks a bit of a two-part question. I'll cover off the first part. He asks, what are your midterm goals for the series in the next 2 to 5 years? We've already covered that for the most part, of this new engine coming in 2021 and a goal for a new chassis in 2022. He also asks, what are your longer-term plans, maybe that 5-year to 7-year out? So we hear a lot about, again, kind of the 5-year plan, but curious if you've looked beyond that 5-year, just, you know, fantasy what IndyCar might look like somewhere in the mid-2020s.
Well, I think if this plan, right, so it takes us through 2026, so there's, and again, this plan was created by, you know, a phenomenal job by our entire paddock, our manufacturer partners, vendors, suppliers, you know, that we all came up with this plan together, which, you know, we couldn't be more proud of. That plan gets us through there, right? So it creates the three manufacturers and the buckets of teams and the growth. And we want to make sure that, you know, this, there's job creation and all these things as this thing hopefully continues to grow and expand. Our partners, our new partners at NBC, they're going to have the entire season. All these little things, you know, some little, some bigger that we're doing, that we just can see that this thing continue to grow,
yeah.
And go in the same direction. And as it does this, it's just have this mushroom effect. It's just going to get bigger, bigger, bigger. And, you know, if you talk to some of our partners or vendors, they're very busy right now. People are buying things. The suppliers, they've had to up their inventories. There's all these new things that we have, new teams coming in. So, you know, it's easy for us, or it's not easy because I don't like to talk about it, but, you say, well, how are things going? Well, we do things because we think it's the right thing to do. Yeah. So obviously our opinion is skewed or biased. But if you just look at the results and what's really happening with the series right now, it seems like the plan is working. We'll show up in St. Pete next year with 25, 26 cars. We ended last year at Sonoma with 25 cars and, you know, 8 rookies. And I think it's not just the quantity that we're seeing right now, but the quality is very good. The Dragon Speed announcement this week, there's another really good team coming in. We're very excited about that. So again, this is just all little pieces of this puzzle that every year we're adding to it. And as it grows, you know, we've got a nice trajectory through 2026 with this plan that I think is, we just got to keep executing what we're doing and fine tuning it, making it better. And I think we're on a good path.
Well, amen to that, Brother Fry. All right, let's see. Where shall we go next? This is a bit of a fun one from our pal Carlos Villalobos. He says, "Dear Mr. Fry, congratulations on your new appointment. Can we view this new position as indicating that the technical rules are ready. You have a third manufacturer closed for the new formula, and now you can devote all your time to other steps in the plan. So, you know, come on, fess up, Fry. This new position, it's just because you're just waiting to announce that third engine manufacturer, right?
Right. Well, thank you, Carlos. We appreciate that. It's been really good. Again, it's funny. This is one of the things about motorsports in general, at times people don't understand. It's busier from the checkered flag at Sonoma to Christmas than any other time of the year, right? Because this is when everything's starting to happen. You're getting everything ready for the following season, the next season down the road, the five-year plan, that type of thing. So it's been nonstop since Sonoma. Once you start racing, you know, you get into your routine. You do the same stuff every week, just a different place, that type of thing. So it's been incredibly busy. We've had a lot of really great OEM visits. There is definitely enthusiasm for what we're doing. It's funny, one of the things when we talk to them, and Mark, we talked about this before, I think it's very important that we're authentic in what we're doing. And, you know, IndyCar, we're fast and loud. We're proud of what we're doing. We're coming at you. It's, you know, these race car drivers we have, they're spectacular. And that's resonating with these folks that we are authentic and we do what we do and we try to do it the best we can. So it's we've had a very exciting off season to this point, and we feel very good about what could possibly be next. And remember, we talk about a timeline. You know, you know it's May-ish, you know, for a 2021 entry, and an OEM would, if we get fortunate enough to have something done by May-ish, you know, they would start testing in 2020. As well, the Chevrolet and Honda with the new engine for implementation in 21. So, you know, again, stay tuned. We feel good. You know, that there's definitely some irons in the fire.
Let's go to Andy Bauer, who brings us back to NBCSN. And I did reach out and ask a senior person at NBCSN if they could help with this answer, and haven't heard back yet. But maybe you can fill this in, maybe not, knowing that this is kind of a presidential question compared to a competition question. And he says, when do you foresee fans being able to pay to live stream races without a cable provider like Formula One does? He says, I don't have cable, but would pay $50 to $100 a year directly to IndyCar to live stream races. And he also mentioned he was disappointed to see that the NBC Gold streaming package won't include races. He says it seems like IndyCar is a little bit behind on the streaming content delivery curve. So, don't know if you can weigh in there on any of that, but I know this is something that, like one of the earlier questions on esports, seems to be more of a growing point of interest for our fans.
Well, it's something that we're very conscious of. Yes, we're very comfortable with our you know, NBC relationship and going forward with the Gold package, and we're also, the IndyCar app will be much more robust next year in a lot of different ways. But there's a lot of good points that were just brought up, and it's kind of an ongoing evolution of what we're going to do next, but it's something we're very conscious of. So I would say, you know, stay tuned on that one too. There could be some, you know, other things coming that would accommodate that.
All right, let's jump to Ryan Perry. Bit of a process question. He says, with Dragon Speed being announced as the newest IndyCar team, what is the process of getting into IndyCar? And what is something that you would like to change about that system or process? So, Fry and Pruitt Motorsports wants to hit the grid at St. Pete. We can go buy a Dallara, I guess, if we want, and we can reach out. Yep. But what's the formal process if we decided, hey, we got the money, we got the desire, let's go? How do we start the process of gaining access to the series?
Well, that's a great question. It's true. It is very open. I mean, if you have the wherewithal and you know, sponsorship and that type of thing, you can buy a team. You can start a team from scratch. There's many different ways to go about it. You know, so I guess the most formal process is they contact us. We kind of go through what their ideas are, what their timelines are, how they want it to work. You know, that type of thing. We guide them. We connect them with you know, supplier partners. You know, if they're wanting to talk to certain drivers, we connect them with the drivers. So there's many, many tentacles, I would say, we're involved with, you know, all the way through the process. You know, and that's basically, if you look at all the new teams we have now, one of the things, you know, really proud of, like with, you know, Mike Shank, you know, that I mean, they're coming in a really good way, that they have a plan, you know, and he has a, you know, 2 or 3 year plan until he runs, you know, which he's publicly stated many times, he wants to run, eventually run full time. Well, they come in and run, you know, 5 or 6, the next year they do 10 or 12, the following year, that, you know, hopefully the goal is to be able to run the whole season. So I think that approach is very good. It helps you get going. It helps you understand how it works. This is a very, very competitive series. It becomes more competitive every day as it expands. Again, we talked about a little bit ago about it's not just the quantity of all the new entries we have. There's a lot of really good quality, and it's just, you know, it's a very exciting time. And but again, it's certainly possible to come in if you want to. So have them give me a call.
It's a party, yeah. And maybe the take home message here, Ryan, is there are some racing series in the world that are very strict and or place a lot of, I don't know if I want to say barriers, but all kinds of qualifications, and you got to get this permission or this license or this, you know, whatever. IndyCar hasn't really, the modern day IndyCar has not been that series. I mean, there are definitely some questions, right? You can ring Chevy and say, hey, I'd like an engine. You can ring Honda and say, I'd like an engine. They don't have to say yes, right? That's up to them. When it comes to your driver, it is definitely, that's maybe the one area that I would say, if you're wanting to start a team, that's the one area where IndyCar is somewhat strict in saying, hey, don't show up with some joker.
Right,
you know, make sure this person has serious qualifications. You, Jay, have implemented the kind of guidelines for that. There's some exceptions. I know Ben Hanley, if we come back to the Dragon Speed, Ben's, if you were just to look at his racing resume, probably wouldn't stand out as, you know, boy, serious, he's going to knock down all the champions and become the greatest in the world. But a little bit of a deeper dive between you and team owner Elton Julian, you know, helped explore the fact that, no, although his racing record isn't crazy in terms of wins and championships all over, the guy's actually pretty darn solid. And, you know, if a Santino Ferrucci is in the series, if a, you know, pick whomever else, Mateus Lace is in the series, someone like Ben Hanley or someone of similar qualifications probably shouldn't be barred from entry as well. So, but that's really the one area where engine manufacturer and driver qualifications are probably the most formidable things just to get approved.
Yes, and then from a driver's perspective, when we do the guideline, you know, part of that's to test too. So, you know, we have another handful of rookies this year that are obviously, you know, very qualified to do lots of different things. But we monitor, you know, at the beginning of the year some of these tests, and we, you know, approve or disapprove or suggest things as we go through the process. So we keep, you know, very close watch of anybody that's coming in that's new, and you know, make sure that they're completely up to speed.
Which is why I don't drive race cars. Let's see.
Thank you.
All right, let's dive into one here that's a little bit of a deeper one. And this was posed by our friend Scott Christie, who sent this in to Mark Miles originally, but I mentioned this might be best for you. He's asking, what is the status of the investigation into Robert Wicken's accident? And if it's complete, what recommendations have come from the report? Will there be any changes to catch fencing, et cetera, et cetera? And he also says, on another note, whatever it is that you're doing, Jay, keep doing it. I've been watching what I can while in Australia and love the racing. So curious about the takeaways from Robert's Pocono crash. And he asks about the catch fencing, but also I know, and some of this probably hasn't been reported, and I'm not going to crack it open unless you do, but, you know, there are also some maybe vehicle things as well that emerge. But just curious where that's at, and if there are any actionable items you can speak on to come from it.
Yes, well, thank you. Great question. We appreciate you watching from Australia. Yeah, it's pretty close to being completely done. And when I say, again, we want to be very thorough. There's parts and pieces that are tested. There's definitely learning along the way. In general, you know, the car did its job, and it performed in a phenomenal way. But you can always learn different things from it. So remember, before this season started, we had the new driver side impact piece, you know, that was part of this AK aero kit this your kit. Yeah,
the vinyl additional cladding and such on the side, yes.
Correct. So that was, we feel very good about that. And we learned from all, incidents throughout the course of the year. So we're compiling all those parts and pieces. We're compiling everything we need to do differently going forward. We're getting suggestions from different supplier partners. So there'll be a few things that are different going forward. Probably too early to discuss exactly what all that is. I don't think it's anything you would say that would be major in any way. There's things that are in the cockpit that could be moved. There's different pieces. One of the things we've done, and this didn't have anything to do with that particular incident, but our tethering system that we have on the cars, we figured out there's possibly a shelf life on these things. So we've created a color coding system going forward. So this year you'll see them, or they're hard to see, but if you ever see one, they'll be yellow, and they're good for 24 months. So 24 months from now, the yellow ones will be gone, and you'll have to have all blue or whatever the next color is. So there's ways that our tech group can, when they're inspecting the cars, can see things very clearly of what is what. So little things like that we're, again, we do this every day. We take safety very seriously. We're really proud of Robert, and I'm sure a lot of people watch what he's doing and the great determination he has. So there'll be more after the first year. One of the things right now, how we go through a cadence of the year. We have a team manager meeting in October, go through a lot of things. Usually have a driver meeting in December. This year we moved the driver meeting to January. So there's probably 20 things that are still open that we want to close. Mm. And we wanted the driver's input on all these things before we close them. And the driver's meeting is first week of January. So we'll get through that. And then we have an idea on each one. It's very important that they have input on all this type stuff. So we're waiting to have that meeting before we finalize those 20 topics, items.
Let me ask this, and this is just more setting maybe expectations. One of the great things about modern day IndyCar, especially with you and Mark Miles and others who've come on board, the level of transparency has been pretty amazing, right? If you're thinking of doing something, if there are changes going to be made, I know you look to fan input and just trying to be more open and include IndyCar's fan base in what IndyCar is doing compared to just being more silent, hey, whatever, we don't care. Do you see this full accident investigation in the report once it's complete? Is that something that you think is made public, or is that kept internal because the findings, I guess, maybe are more for yourselves and what to change than an announcement of what happened to others?
Well, probably a little bit of both, right? So the when I say public or transparent part is we'll get with all of the team managers and teams, drivers, and explain some of the things that happened. We'll come up with some of the ideas we have to make changes to make it better. We'll also ask them for input on that, too, because one of the things we've tried to do the last few years is, we call it harnessing the power of the paddock. Mm. This paddock has got some very, very smart people. So why not have them help us come up with a solution? And, again, that's probably what the next step is, that we've got ideas. We want to show them what our ideas are, see if they can help us make our ideas even better, and then the next step is obviously implementation. So there's not a lot of things probably different in this regard, but there's definitely things that we can improve on. You can always improve, right? So we'll definitely improve. One of the things you mentioned about the fan, of course, fans, when we built the new aero kit, we started putting out drawings. And fan feedback from those drawings, those renderings, were very, very important to us. We read every one of them to see if they thought we were going in the right direction or not. Because if you remember, too, we kind of reverse engineered the car where we went with the aesthetics kind of first, where we wanted it to kind of have a historical feel. So once the fans basically signed off on it, really, is when we really started going with the performance end of the car to make sure it performed like we wanted to also. So it's a group effort. I mean, we're all in this together, the fans, the paddock, all of our promoter partners, our broadcast partner with NBC. So it's something that we can all help make this sport even better.
might be the most important question of all coming up next. This is courtesy of I Forgot My Password OK via Reddit. For Jay, what is your prediction for the Liberty Bowl on New Year's Eve? Mizzou or Oklahoma State?
Oh, easy. Go Tigers. Yes, thank you. I mean, that's kind of cool. So that, I'm showing my age now, because when I was there, we were in the Big Eight back then. So obviously Oklahoma State was part of the Big Eight. And what a cool, you know, kind of historical feel rivalry. You know, talking about historical. You know, it'll be great. Coach Gundy was actually in school when I was in school. So it's just, it's, and then, you know, Barry Odom, the head coach of Missouri, is a good friend who played there. Andy Hill, who's an assistant at Missouri, was a teammate of mine. So it's really cool. I'm glad to see it. Really proud of how they're playing. I think that program's certainly on the rise again, and Barry and Andy and everybody's doing a great job.
Let's jump to...
How about that? Football stuff.
Well, I mean, look, you smashed into people on behalf of the school. I mean, good Lord, you know, yeah, of course you're going to be proud.
This is a lot of diverse podcasts, right?
See,
a lot
of
different topics.
Look, man, I tried to actually... I attempt to do something that isn't totally dumb on occasion, so I try and stack the serious Wiccans followed by a football... Let's go back to another question. These are just awesome names. Beer League Chirper at Knuckle Pucker on Twitter. I mean, right?
Our kind of guy.
I wish I'd thought of that one. Asks, what's the latest with the LED display panels returning for 2019? And also says, I really appreciate the live track position information, pit stop stopwatch, push to pass activation, and other info for us fans in attendance. So you and I have talked about this a lot, you know, privately or via text, because we get this question all the time. But what do you think, Mr. Fry, when we get to St. Pete?
Well,
you think we're going to have panels, or is that still a toss of the coin?
There's a lot of pressure on these panels on us.
Isn't that amazing, by the way? Just of all the things, we've got these amazing 2.2-liter twin-turbo V6s that are like space technology and this and that. These freaking LED panels, man, these are like the favorite things ever almost.
Yes. Well, this is when we mentioned about listening to our fans. Personally, I don't get it, right? So what to put on the LED parts, but I understand our fans want it.
Oh, yeah.
So we're working diligently to figure out how to come up with a solution. So if you think a couple years ago we had a kind of a basic program, it, you know, it was cool. Then we come up with something that was even more robust, and we had some issues with that. So we've went back, I guess. We've got a prototype, or a couple prototypes being built that we think can do it. It's probably somewhere in the middle of the two. And we should have those hopefully on a couple cars to test it right off the bat in next season. And remember, the car's already built to take these panels, so it's kind of a plug-and-play thing at that point if we can get comfortable with the panels. What was happening, too, is we were putting a big – there were so many things going wrong that it was a burden on the teams, and the teams were – you know, they have other things to be, you know, going on a race weekend, and these panels were having problems, and – you know, we had cars on the grid that the panels weren't on, and there was just a lot of things to it. I think it's a great idea. It's cool. We just want to make sure it's done right. And, you know, again, we understand, and we've got a solution that we think will be very close. And it seems very elementary, very simple, which, like, just fix that. You know, but it has not been that elementary or that simple. The cars, the harmonics and the vibration of the cars are much greater than what people would imagine, I think, in the way the cars flex and the, you know, the diversity of the racetracks we go to. There's just a lot to it. So we are on it. We understand. And, you know, we're looking forward to having some solution for 19. We've even looked at some other things, too, that are not necessarily the LED panels. There's some other new technology that's coming out.
Holograms that above the car, maybe?
Yeah, so it could be cool. We've got a couple technology companies we're talking to that have some other ideas. So, you know, we get it, and we understand it's important to the fans, and we want to provide what, you know, what they want. So hopefully, you know, I don't ever like to say things and then it doesn't happen, but we're working diligently to get it done, yes.
And do you think those call them test or R&D panels, or things you would ask teams to put on the cars once they get back out and testing for private, you know, private outings in January, or would you hold till, you know, the spring training at COTA?
No, we'll put them on because we won't have, at COTA, we wouldn't have enough. or I should say we might, because if we put on a couple cars that test early January and everything seems fine, again, this the group we're using, they have history in doing these type things, and so we're comfortable with that. If we put it on the cars and it works well right off the bat, we could possibly have it on more cars at COTA. And then after COTA, there's obviously a few more weeks before we go to St. Pete. Again, it's the car's already built to take these panels, so it would not be it should not be that big a deal to get inventory enough to do it by St. Pete. So kind of stay tuned. I just wanted to, you know, obviously let everybody know that we are working diligently to get it done. We do have a couple prototypes being built that we should get any day, and we'll see how these work.
I think you need to bolt them onto your daily driver and, pound around greater speedway
right.
In Indianapolis. Let's see.
That could work.
Let's go back to our friend John Sable. Another very salient question for the future of IndyCar. John says, Jay, when do you see electrification of IndyCars happening? I say when, because I've given in that the internal combustion engine is going away in the next 50 years, maybe sooner. And while I love the fast and loud concept that is coming in IndyCar's future, you can't ignore road-going automotive progress. So while I don't want silent IndyCars anytime soon, amen, thank you, John, I don't know how long they're going to be around. So I'm curious if you have something in mind, a date in the future where maybe adding in an electric component to the combustion engine might be real in IndyCar.
Well, this is, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to go on this question. It's a great question. When we did the new engine regulations for 2021, both our current partners and all the other OEM partners that we talk to on a regular basis, or not partners, hopefully prospects, you'd say, but we have friends with lots of the different OEMs, all thought that the 2.4 liter twin turbo V6 is very relevant in what they're doing. They all have them, excuse me, and they thought that was a great way to go. And it fit right into our authentic, our fast and loud. You know, this new engine is going to be a little louder. It's going to have 100 more horsepower right out of the box. So obviously technology is changing every day. There's been things with fuel, even that people are talking about for the future that could be carbon neutral. It could be different. We're comfortable with where we're going through 2026. So, between now and then, who knows what comes up next? And maybe it's not electrification. Maybe it's something else. But we've talked about different things. You could have a pit road type situation where the cars hit pit road, they hit a line, the engine shuts off, it's electric throughout the course of. There's lots of things that we could possibly do. There's lots of great ideas. But at this point, again, we really feel like what we're doing is relevant. We really feel like our current partners are on board, our OEM partners, and the ones that we've talked to were also thinking that was the right direction to go. So, again, I think being authentic is a good thing. I think all motorsports series kind of have their own kind of niche or kind of what they do. And, obviously Formula E is... what they're doing, and they're authentic, and they're getting better at it every day, and it's interesting to watch or interesting to see how that progresses. So I guess the bottom line is we think we're on a good path where we're at right now, and then I'm sure things coming in the next few years that could be even that we're not even completely aware of that could be what could possibly be next.
Got about 10 minutes to go, Jay, before we need to cut you loose. And we should mention up front, you are just coming here from lunch with our man, Robin Miller. And as I mentioned before we started recording, I don't know what you did wrong, but clearly you're paying for it by having to go to dinner with that guy or lunch with that guy. Kidding aside, so I'll prioritize a couple of things here that might be more interesting on a newsy standpoint. Theodore Paul Cooper asks, any track changes in plan for the Laguna Seca test in February? And that comes from, I think, part of the discussion of, we're obviously going to WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, but there are some things, whether it might be safety adjustments, hey, this curb should be tweaked or add some barrier, you know, tires and whatnot there. Curious if there are things that we might see in place at this February test that speak to any IndyCar-related adjustments.
Yeah, there'll be probably half of the things I think that are on the big list will be done by the test. Just since everything you just mentioned, it's just kind of all the way around. There's different places that we need more robust fencing. We need more different kind of safer areas, runoffs, that type of thing. So they've been great to work with. They're diligently going through this list. And I don't know if it'll be completely visible. You'll see some, you know, you'll see some of it, obviously. But there's lots of little things throughout the course that they're doing to get ready for us. And again, we couldn't be more excited to be going there.
Let's go to Anthony Pienta, who says, Jay, as someone with experience in both IndyCar and NASCAR, what sort of collaboration might make sense for both groups? Driver swaps, shared events, etc. It seems there are a lot of potential crossover fans who don't see motorsports as an either-or offering, you know, picking either I'm an IndyCar person or NASCAR person alone. Anthony thinks there might be more folks that would love to see the two organizations team up on something. Do you think there's anything there?
Absolutely, and I agree with Anthony. We actually had a week or two ago, we had a big motorsports summit at NBC, and that was kind of one of the things we it was great that they put it on. You know, we went through a lot of different things, best practices, how different leagues do different things. You think about it, you know, with us and say NASCAR or IMSA, or, you know, there's a lot of crossover and ownership. So it's, I think I agree. I'm a huge motorsports fan. I like all of it. And as a fan, the more you can get of it, the better. You think we run with IMSA at Long Beach and Detroit, you know, great events for us, great events for them. You know, it's just, it's an enhancement for the fans. When we go to Gateway, there's going to be a Can-Am race, you know, the same day that, you know, a Can-Am NASCAR race, the same day we run, so there'll be a bigger ticket on Saturday. You know, the trucks at Texas, there's lots of things I think that we can do that benefit all of us, and I think there are lots of motorsports fans out there that just like to watch, I mean, whichever motorsports series they're watching, so I think it behooves all of us to have a very open mind, and you know what could be possible. You know, who knows? But just you think of the things that we're currently doing are seem to be working and seem to be successful when we do things together. So why not look at doing more together?
I love that. We're all friends here. We're trying to be friends, at least.
Absolutely.
Howard Bennett has a question, and I know it may be. Encroaches a little bit on the Robert Wickens investigation topic, but might be more of a standalone too. Howard says, question to Jay, catch fencing. Are there any future plans for redesigns, incorporation of new technology, or anything that comes to mind that might lessen the impact of those troublesome and worrying solid vertical sections and posts? So coming out of Pocono, and I should say not just Pocono, but any thoughts or any developments in the background with any safety-related partners where we might see some new barrier technology either being tested or implemented in the near future?
Yeah, well, all of that. Like we mentioned earlier, safety is a huge priority for us, and it is for all motorsports series, right? So Tony Kottman, who works with us, is on a FIA circuit commission, and you know, there's lots of things being looked at, lots of things being tested universally. We do things too. NASCAR obviously does things, the safer barriers. We have, you know, a relationship there with that, with them. So we're looking at lots of different things. I think it's very important that we, you know, just because something's been done a certain way for a certain period of time doesn't mean that's the only way to do it anymore. And, you know, it's important. If you think about before the safer barriers, I don't think anybody thought anything like that would have made sense or could have worked, but that's been hugely successful. I think anything we can do to make the venues, the cars, you know, anything we can do from a safety perspective, you know, we need to do, and we need to have an open mind. So there's lots of things being looked at this point. Would I say there's any kind of direction? Not necessarily yet, but, would I personally look forward to what's possible, and we'll just keep working as hard as we can on it.
All right, let's grab two more quick questions and then say farewell. First, we will go to, how about Ed Joris, who says, Jay, do you think the series needs more of a presence in the Northeast Mid-Atlantic area? Got any venues in mind, like VIR, Monticello, or maybe revisiting New Hampshire? And I'll just throw in my vote, as I say somewhat frequently, IndyCar needs to go to VIR. It's amazing. But what do you think there? Yeah. You think that kind of, East Coast, Mid-Atlantic area? Any thoughts as to whether IndyCar might try and add a date there in the future? Because we know we have fans.
Absolutely. The one that always comes top of my mind is Watkins Glen.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously we were there, a few years ago. Michael Prinnip does a phenomenal job. It was great what they did when we had the situation that we were able to go there the first year as quickly as we did. It's a great venue that's very well run. I think we can't discount something happening there in the future. Different date, et cetera, that could, make it, better, but there's lots of great. The Northeast has race fans everywhere, so VIR is a great venue. You've been there many times. We geographically. One of the things that you think about that was important was the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah,
we had kind of a hole up there, and it was so cool going to Portland this year. The lines early in the morning. We had drivers that were. A little tardy for the driver's meeting, race morning, because they were stuck in traffic. What a great problem to have. The historic shirts that fans had on, from back in the day type stuff. You saw, Rick Mears shirts everywhere, things like that. It was a really cool inaugural event or inaugural coming back, and just see great things happening with that in the future. So, the Northeast, I guess, is a place right now where we do have a little bit of a hole, and it would be great to fill it in with some sort of great event, yes.
All right, well, I'm going to keep bugging my pal Connie at VIR and you to make sure that we get that, at least a test, an IndyCar test at VIR. Man, I bet you put 10 or 15,000 people on the gate just to see the test.
That's kind of what you do, right? You started off with something like that. Let's go see what happens. Let's see how it worked. You've got... Charlotte came out with their Roval. There's lots of things that could be possible on the East Coast or the Northeast too. So we got to have an open mind going forward. One of the things we worked really hard on is to have data equity and consistency in our schedule year over year. So we think we're doing well with that. So now what's next? What's next is the series expands, and if there's other opportunities to go to other great venues, absolutely. So it's exciting times.
All right, let's close out our holiday episode of the Week in IndyCar with our man Travis Bender, who says, any updates on IndyCar's future international races? Says there have been tons on the table, if the internet is to be believed recently, which are most likely to be real. So I know, again, strapping on your brand new president cap, I don't know if we're asking you to be an odds maker here, Jay, but are there any that are feeling more promising than others at this stage?
My new hat, all this stuff I was already involved in, kind of. So, I would say very enthused about all the things coming out of Australia.
Yeah.
Obviously, you look at Portland, how great it was going back there. Well, Australia in the day was hugely successful, right? So, the time of year it fits, everything fits. There's been great enthusiasm from the Australian government. Our man Will Power was over there on a mission for us this winter and come back with some great stuff. So, it feels good. We certainly would be interested there. Obviously, it appears there's interest there too. So who knows? There's a lot of things to happen between those two points, though, right? There's a lot of details that have to be worked out. It's a big, big, big undertaking. So we'll see what happens. But it appears there's enthusiasm there. So that might be a good odds one, I guess.
Mr. Fry, thank you as always for not only making time for me, but making time for IndyCar fans this holiday episode. I hope we'll folks will enjoy, maybe celebrating with family, celebrating with some merry drinks and otherwise, and definitely hoping that you and the delightful Mrs. Fry wish the two of you not only the best, but thank you for all that you do for us. And man, I genuinely cannot wait for 2019 to get here.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be on here, Marshall. We certainly appreciate you and all you do. And again, like from a fan perspective, it's extremely important. We take everything. We look at all the comments. We certainly pay attention, and we hope we're going in a good direction. Again, it feels, you know, again, we talk about harnessing the power of the paddock. We got so many great people in this sport. It's such a pleasure to be part of it. And, you know, the sky's the limit. We just want to wish everybody a happy holiday.